to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, welcome to episode 14 of the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm out in Brooklyn, New York. I was invited out here by Rob Pione, who you will know as Crypto Bobby. He invited me out here to meet up with the AirSwap team, who've just launched their new decentralized marketplace for crypto trading, which is pretty cool. I interviewed Don from the team, but that will come out next week. I also, while I was here, I wanted to have a catch up with Rob and talk about a few things with him. I'm in the office, so there's a bit of noise in the background that you'll hear with this, and there's a bit of noise during both interviews, but I wanted to come out here and just check out everything they're doing. So this intro will be shorter than most of the other ones I do because it's Thursday. I want to get the interview out tomorrow, so I'm just wrapping this up before I get my flight back to England. Just a couple of things though before I do. I've put the finishing touches together for my crypto trading course. That's now available on my website. You can access that at www.whatbitcoindid.com/training, or just go to the website and click on the training section. I put that course together. It really is a helpful guide for anyone new coming into the space to help them learn about how to safely invest in crypto assets. It's free at the moment. It might be free forever, so feel free to take a look and feel free to shove me any feedback you have on the course. I know a few people have enjoyed it. It kind of covers everything from a really basic point of view, you know, what crypto assets are, why they're important, and there's step-by-step guides on how to sign up to exchanges and use them. So yeah, if you use that, I hope you like it. Feel free to share it out with anyone else. Outside of that, yeah, just support the show as normal. Please provide us a review on iTunes. Please follow me on social media. My handle on every single one is at WhatBitcoinDid, and you can find me on Twitter, Medium, Steemit, and Instagram, and you can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Lastly, you can check out my blog. I write a few things about crypto occasionally. It's www.whatbitcoindid.com, and I also have a newsletter you can subscribe to. Okay, so I'll move on to the chat with Rob. It's not like a normal interview. It's more of a, you know, we just have a chat about a few other things going on in crypto right now, but I do hope you enjoy it. As ever, feedback is always welcome. Feel free to reach out to me on any channel or email me on hello@whatbitcoindid, and I'll try and get back to you as soon as possible. Okay, speak to you soon. So am I going to call you Rob, Robbie, Bobby, Robert?
You can call me Rob. You can go with Rob. That works.
Great to meet you. Thanks for having me here in Brooklyn and taking me out for dinner last night.
Yeah, appreciate you coming.
It's cool. So we had a lot of drama last night.
A little bit.
And yesterday with a story exposed of market manipulation.
Yeah.
What do you make of this? What are your thoughts?
So I think that it's something that a lot of people obviously got angry about. Like, it went pretty viral on Twitter pretty quick, and there was a ton of outrage on it, which is, I think, understandable. I do think that it goes on, and it's much more prevalent than probably just a group of 10 people, and probably goes on a much larger level. And if anything, maybe it just kind of goes to show that, you know, not everybody, and I'm, you know, I don't know, I haven't done enough research to know if those individuals who were kind of accused of it were truly involved or kind of the extent of their involvement. But I do think it goes to show that there definitely is some level of manipulation, or people trying to manipulate the markets for their own benefit, and then a lot of times in detriment to you as an individual. So definitely something that you want to think about if you are trading in the crypto markets or investing in the crypto markets.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when I wrote my training course recently, I put in there that you have to be aware that manipulation happens. And I think we're all aware there's lots of pump and dump groups. Have you been invited to some?
I have not. Oh, actually, I mean, they might be in my Twitter mentions, but I typically just, anybody that puts like a SIG or, you know, a Telegram pump and dump group, I'll just block. So
right, okay.
I'll never see them again.
So I've had it in my DMs. Do you want to join? And, you know, I would be the biggest idiot to join one, but I think we're all aware it's going on, and it's clearly going on, but I don't think that should be a reason to validate it. And it feels like some of the responses were, well, it's going on so much, so, you know, you just have to accept it. And that's almost like some approval.
Yeah, I know. I definitely don't think anybody should be happy about it or approve it or kind of put a blessing on it and say, this is fine. I do think the one interesting thing, though, is a lot of people, at least I posted a little bit about it and kind of joked around and said I was absolutely shocked. And obviously I'm not shocked, just because I've figured that it's been going on for a while. And, you know, you've seen these pump. It's not the first time that there have been like major articles and major publications about these pump and dump groups and things like that. But there's not necessarily maybe I think the reason this caught fire was because there were crypto influencers behind it specifically that people followed or people trusted and or thought they trusted. And I think that that made it take off a lot more than something like, you know, just seeing an article with some random person that you don't necessarily have any interaction with. And then you hear about like a pump and dump behind that.
And I guess the bad thing about it is they've built a following of people who trust them.
Yep.
And if they are going to operate a pump and dump, they essentially have to dump on their followers. Because if you look
into... Dumping on somebody.
Well, yeah, dumping on somebody. And if you look
into... It's most likely your followers, potentially.
Yeah, and if you look into the conversations, a lot of the discussion was around, you know, who's got the followers? Mm-hmm. How can we shill this to the most people? And I think some people think of this as like a victimless crime sometimes and seem to forget, actually, not everybody can make money in the market.
No. I think there's, in a lot of cases, a winner and loser on every trade. And there's somebody there, the person pumping it is usually the person that's probably going to be winning. And somebody else is going to be buying that at an elevated valuation and probably not going to be breaking even anytime in the near future, which is, you know, it's sad to see, especially for the people that are new in the space that don't get it. I would say, though, that it's interesting, too, because like a lot of times you'll see these crazy moves that people will celebrate where something goes up 50% in an hour, 80%, 100%, or whatever it might be, like crazy moves. You know, that's obviously – there's something going on behind the scenes. There's some level of manipulation there, and it's funny that it took for like a Steemit article that it, you know, had a couple different people for that to kind of generate this conversation. But if anything, I do think it's – regardless of, I guess, the people behind it, I do think it's good to have the conversation on kind of how it's, in a lot of cases, bad for the space and how you should be aware of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's clearly been going on, and I think we're all aware when the prices go up. And as one person said, you know, you should be thanking these pumpers. That, you know, they're the people making you money. But I don't think it's right to validate it. You know, it's if this market is going to grow up and be taken more seriously, I don't think we should be celebrating things like this.
No, and I think it also, like, I saw a lot of people calling for regulation, too, where it's like, this is why we need regulation, this is why we need regulation. And I do think it also brings up an interesting point, because there are a lot of people that are very much anti-regulation in the space until they find something that they don't necessarily like, and then it's, you know, where's the regulation, where's the regulator, save us, save us, save us. So I think that's kind of funny to see, like, you know, the people that may or may not be anti-regulator or regulation, and then something like this happens where there's accusations of pump and dumps and things like that, and then people are begging regulators to come in the space and stop it.
Yeah, it's funny because there's almost like a different drama every week that kicks
it's
off.
Like every day.
Yeah, every day. Something new kicks off. And yeah, when you think about this as a potentially multi-trillion industry, it seems quite amateur at times and immature.
It's still highly, highly immature. I think there's, you know, It's going to the maturity of the space is going to only, in my opinion, it's only going to increase, and it's increasing rapidly on literally like a daily basis. I mean, there are massive investors moving into the space. There's, I think, one of the biggest plays is the infrastructure behind, behind the crypto markets. And even, you know, you saw, I don't know if you saw yesterday, but I think it was the CEO of NASDAQ coming out saying, you know, we'd be interested in essentially operating as a cryptocurrency exchange in the future. If the regulation is, you know, the regulation is straightened out and things like that, like there are larger players that are, I think, interested in providing the infrastructure behind the scenes, but some things need to get straightened out. And I think some people are going to take those risks and move quicker so that they can get, like the CME and the CBOE move pretty quick. And some people are saying, hey, you shouldn't do that. But I do think that people understand that there's probably a lot of money to be made from a corporate perspective, and they're ready to do that.
And I guess it's their own version of FOMO, right? They don't want to miss out on this. I saw that thing. It's like 1 to 2 years they expect, but I guess they'll be eyeing up other exchanges they can buy rather than do it themselves.
Yeah, and you've even seen it too with some of the, I think, the M&A going on in the exchanges. Like that seems to be the one area, and I maybe a little bit like surprised by that. I thought maybe there might be like more regulatory concerns, like with Circle acquiring Poloniex. And then I think it was...
Deal's going to look pretty cheap in a couple of years at $400 million.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. And then Coincheck Coincheck's in Japan, the one that got hacked for a bunch of NEM, they got acquired. And then I think the rumor, there's another rumor, I think it's a Korean or Japanese exchange, I forget off the top of my head if it's forget who it is, but there's talks about them getting acquired for $400 million recently. So that might come to fruition. Who knows? But it seems like the mergers and acquisitions in the exchange space by traditional companies that want exposure to this market is something that's definitely heating up.
Yeah, it feels like we're approaching that tipping point. There's a couple of other things that came out. I'm pretty sure I saw, was it a minister in South Korea who came out and said that he expects cryptocurrencies to replace fiat. And I think we've also had A16Z, Andreas Horowitz, have announced they've announced a crypto fund now.
They've been
80 million.
They've been pretty active in investing, I think, in IC or initial coin offerings, in venture capital, traditional VC, and a funding for crypto companies as well. So they seem to be the most, or one of the most active, like traditional VC firms. So that's, I think it's a pretty interesting sign to see them creating a crypto only fund. And I do think it's something that there are a lot of larger investors that want some level of exposure. I've gone to like a lot of these conferences recently, and that's like been the one panel I always want to sit in on is hearing about the institutional investors and kind of like what they're thinking. And that seems to me like there's a certain progression where it's like the riskiest, the ones that are most comfortable with risk are moving, whether it's family offices or prop trading units. And then like pension funds are very, very far out in terms of actually adopting, but having some level of exposure to their portfolio, if it be it 1% or 2% to the crypto markets, is something that they want to take on.
I guess the challenge as well is, what is it they're investing in? Because you can either be investing in infrastructure businesses who have some kind of enterprise value, but you also can be invested in token-based businesses where it's a token economy and the enterprise has no value. And I think that's like a whole new world for this level of investment.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see that develop. Yeah, like is it, are you investing in like a Coinbase that has probably traditional business metrics and an actual like a way to apply valuation, or are you investing in Ethereum or an ERC-20 token that nobody knows how to value?
Yeah.
Either of those things. Nobody knows how to value Bitcoin. So,
well, it's valued what, at 8,800 now?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you survive the crash of 2018?
It hasn't been fun. It definitely hasn't been fun. I did buy a little bit more in the sub, I think it was the sub $7,000 range, around 6,800. I didn't time it perfectly in the bottom, but I did try to increase my stack there. That was one thing. For the most part, I'm not like an incredibly active trader. So I've kind of taken things as they've come and then tried to rebalance my portfolio into certain assets that I thought were a little bit higher quality than maybe I was in previously. Back in like December and January, I think you could have just thrown your money into anything and it seems like, I'm gonna double, triple, quadruple this, and this is gonna be great. And then once the correction happened once that correction happened in like late January into February, when a lot of those assets lost 70-80% of their value, looking at that and thinking, okay, like I don't want to be in this. I'm going to move to something that I just feel like has a little bit more maybe long-term value. So I kind of adjusted my portfolio pretty heavily to Bitcoin, to Monero, to other things that I thought, maybe to Ethereum, that I felt a little bit more comfortable holding than kind of a random ERC-20 token or something like that.
So what's your background, Rob? When did you what was your first exposure to crypto and Bitcoin, and when did it really grab you?
So my first entry into the crypto like markets in general was December of 2013. I had somebody, I had heard about Bitcoin a little bit. I was working in IT recruiting at the time, and hated my job, but working in IT recruiting at the time, and I was getting a master's in information systems. So I thought I was just trying to experiment with as like much tech as I could. And somebody sent me an article about Dogecoin, and
you're another Dogecoin.
Yes, yeah, I am.
This keeps coming up.
I'm Dogecoin was what got me interested into crypto. And it was, I mean, back then, like now it's completely different. But back then, it was like in December of 2013, that was like kind of when Dogecoin blew up, like monetarily speaking. And also, I mean, there was a point in time where the community, it was like 80,000 people in their subreddit. It was like super active. They were paying, they were sponsoring people to go to the Jamaican, they sponsored the Jamaican bobsled team. They had a Dogecoin logo on a NASCAR driver. Like they had all this crazy stuff. And it was just a super like fun, like, cause the Bitcoin, and I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist, but I'm a big fan of Bitcoin in general. But like the Bitcoin community was very like intellectual and libertarian, or like even it was just much more hardcore, I think, than even like now, just mm-hmm. because it was so much smaller back then. And the Dogecoin community was just like memes and such moon and stupid things like that, which was kind of funny to me. And I didn't have much money at the time because I was fairly new out of college at that point. So I started trying to mine, and I initially tried to mine on my laptop because you could actually mine Dogecoin on a GPU back then.
Wow.
Or like you, I guess still can now, but you could like pretty effectively do that simply on a laptop. So I was mining there, and then I ended up buying a couple of the like Bitcoin USB ASICs that they used to have until those became basically worthless in the course of once the other ASICs started getting developed. So it was fun to experiment with some of the mining too and kind of get a feel for that.
Mm-hmm. So you were involved then. So you traded a bit through 2014?
Yeah, a little bit, but I mean late 2013, 2014, I basically bought the top. And
yeah,
that was like, I think, you know, Bitcoin and the crypto markets went from $1 billion to $15 billion. I probably bought it when I was at like 13, 14 billion. And kind of bought a little bit on the way up and started just trying to like mine and get myself, you know, just I thought the ability to like I said, I didn't have a ton of money, so like the ability to print money on my computer, on my laptop or whatever, I thought was like the coolest thing in the world. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So I just kind of got like lightly involved then. And then I think like interest for me like waned a little bit, just because it was like a lot of people kind of fell, like as the price continued to drop and drop, like a lot of the activity and interest in 2014, I think, left for a lot of people. And that's kind of what I think has happened similarly this year, which mm-hmm. is kind of why I've told people in some respects, like I'm never one to be like, all right, it's going to go back up, it's going to be perfect, you're going to go past all time highs. But you can see like a similar pattern where like the interest has just died off in 2018. Yep. And that's exactly kind of like how I felt personally in 2014 too. It's like, man, this sucks.
Well, everything correlates. We talked about this last night.
Yeah.
You know, you said with your YouTube videos, like the viewership has dropped. I know with like my Facebook group, the comments and interest has dropped. You know, when the market's going up, everyone's interested.
Yep.
And when the market's totally dropping, they're not. But actually, yeah, one of the things I said to people I talk to is actually this is a time to be like learning and accumulating. And I think you always have to go through a cycle to realize that.
Yeah, it's been a lot easier for me this time where it's been a lot easier. And granted, I'm not somebody who's like, you know, just hodl and don't do anything. Like, I don't think that's the best strategy for everybody, but for some people it's okay. But it's been a lot easier for me to take some of the losses that I have. I've recovered, you know, quite a bit, but it's been a lot easier for me to take some of the losses just because I feel like I've gone through this before and I'll probably go through it again. And like when you've had some experience in these, like they're crazy market cycles. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous. But when you've gone through it once or twice before, it makes it a lot easier to stomach it the next time.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, hopefully your total portfolio value is higher as well. And you kind of know what's happening. Although I'll say, like, do you know, even this time, like, was it like maybe middle of March? I was like, oh no, I think I'm done.
Yeah.
I did have that almost kind of like, that almost kind of like moment I want to leave the market, but it has recovered. So when did you start creating the content then? When did you start thinking, because you're a bit more like me, you're like,
yeah,
you know, you know you're not the best trader, you know you're not going to day trade, but you like making content. So when did that start happening?
Sure. So I started in like early August. I started to kind of play around in a lot more ICOs. I had started to, I was doing better just professionally speaking outside of crypto. So I had more money to kind of put in the market, and I had made money in 2017. So I was just kind of bored one day and threw up a video and did that a couple of days in a row, and it just kind of snowballed, and I really liked doing it and got good feedback from people for the most part. I tried to like make my videos not super crazy in depth and understand that I'm definitely not the smartest person in the world and not try to portray myself as an expert and just be a relatable dude. And hopefully that has, you know, resonated with some people. So yeah, it started in August and just kind of continued ever since.
And how many followers you got to now on YouTube?
It's like 140,000 or something like that, but it's definitely slowed down a lot recently.
But that's still a significant amount, right?
Yeah, I think there's certainly people with more, but it's probably like, I guess like top five or top 10 in terms of like the crypto specific YouTubers.
Does that bring any pressure?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. Like there's pressure on, I don't know. It's like, I'm kind of competitive too. But at the same point in time, like I don't have any, like it's, you know, it's always interesting to see certain people and you can kind of see like the ebb and flow of how some people have like really strong success really quickly. And maybe they fall off or just kind of the ebb and flow of how I would say it's more entertainment than, just kind of specific advice or anything like that.
But you know, there's certain content that's going to get you more viewers and you're not always going to go for that, right?
Yeah. So that's the thing that like I struggle with a lot of times. And I think it's probably hurt me recently, at least, I think it's really easy to cater to a certain type of audience that wants the 5 coins that are going to moon today and the, you know, four best, whatever, the thing that I think is difficult is I like talking about what is like happening. I like just generally speaking, like what's happening in the market, you know, what's happening with regulation, what are some of the new advancements that are going on? I don't really like talking about, okay, these are the 5 coins that I think are going to crush it, because if I recommend 5 coins and 2 of them, first of all, it's not supposed to be financial advice in the first place, but and 2 of them go down 80%, and if I say it, somebody's probably going to put money into it, which is not good in and of itself, but I'm going to feel pretty crappy if, you know, somebody out there is shooting me a message on Twitter commenting and saying, hey, I put money in this because you told me it was going to go up. And, you know, I've seen that happen with other people too. And a lot of times they'll just brush it off and pretend like it doesn't happen. But that's the type of like, everybody wants to be told like, all right, this is what you should do. This is where you should put your money. But that's like not that's the type of content that can do very well, but I don't really like have, I'd rather get half the viewership and not make, you know, this coin is going to go up 100%, like just the clickbaity shit.
Yeah, and this, you know what, it's very hard to predict over a short time frame what will happen. I think like over a long time frame, you can look at Bitcoin and go, you know, it's probably of all of them the most healthy investment. Monero looks pretty good. Mm-hmm. But when you start looking at shorter time frames, you know, Monero really hasn't done anything right now. But I think it's got more chance of existing in 5 years than the number of the tokens that have moved.
Yeah, totally agree.
So you said to me, you are, though, when you are looking at things, you're more into fundamental analysis than technical.
Yeah. I like reading through white papers. My background has been in technology for the most part prior to joining the industry full time. I worked in software sales or enterprise software. And that was like fairly technical in nature. And I just kind of like, that was one of the things that really drew me into the space, was like, I thought the mining itself was really interesting, but like now there's a lot more than just kind of like mining transactional cryptocurrencies. There's a lot of different platforms and things like that. So yeah, I like the fundamental analysis portion of it.
Okay. And so based on that, what 5 coins are going to... No, I'm only joking. So what things are you looking
Dogecoin,
at now?
Dogecoin.
What assets are you looking at? What projects do you find interesting? And
so, I mean, for me, I think one of the things that's probably one of the more interesting things to evaluate is the platforms. Ethereum versus EOS versus Cardano versus Neo versus whatever.
Dragon.
There's so many platforms, and it's interesting because number one, they're super highly valued. Like I was talking to somebody recently and just kind of talking about like the utility of these platforms versus the valuation, and the valuation is just massively beyond the utility. Like so many of them, nobody even uses, but they're worth billions of dollars, like market cap wise, which is not a great metric in and of itself. But
is that not also possibly a reflection of there's so many people that are able to trade in this market now?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, globally, anyone can get on board and start investing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's definitely the case, and yeah, I think that's definitely the case, and I also think like the platform plays are interesting because like everybody if you like go through some of the white papers, there's a lot of them are trying to like look at Ethereum and see what Ethereum is doing and say like, okay, Ethereum doesn't have good transaction scalability. They're never going to scale. They're at whatever 7-10 transactions per second now. And Ethereum is trying to add in like sharding and proof of stake and all these different things. We're going to do that from the outset. And we're trying to, you know, we're trying to implement that. We're trying to like get to mainnet. We're trying to have people develop on top of us, blah, blah, blah. But can Ethereum like move quick enough to basically nullify like the advancements that these other platforms are trying to make? I think that's going to be like an interesting race. I'm almost viewing it like a race, like who's going to get to the finish line. I mean, the finish line's always going to be moving, but like who's going to kind of get to the finish line first, or who's going to complete the first lap? And then I also think too, like watching where the developers are, because you know, you can have the coolest platform on the planet. You could have the, you know, the best scalability out there. But at the same point in time, if there's nobody, if your platform is supposed to be a, you know, decentralized application platform, or people are supposed to build on top of it, nobody's building on top of it, is actually valuable. Maybe it is now, but at some point in time, I feel like the market will look at that and say, right, it's not super valuable.
So based on the platforms that you've looked at, what are the ones you are interested in? And specifically, you know, where do you think the biggest threats to Ethereum are?
I mean, I think like a lot of people are pointing to EOS now. Hashgraph is another one that's like coming out. So the interesting thing about, I think, a lot of these platforms that are maybe competitive to Ethereum is that for the most part, there's a trade-off between, they're all maybe more scalable in nature than Ethereum is, but because they've had an opportunity to see what Ethereum's done and where its like weaknesses are and kind of build that in, bake that into their system. But a lot of times it seems like there's an element of centralization that is like it's more scalable because it's more centralized, whether it's like there's the governance layer is kind of specifically focused on 30 something entities that are designated as, you know, designated as such, or I don't know. I feel like there's this like a big trade-off with centralization of kind of who's actually running it and like the companies behind it, or the people behind it and the actual like scalability of the system. But I think EOS is going to be interesting to watch. Some people love it, some people hate it. Cardano is another one that I think is fairly interesting too. Both, I mean, have pretty significant valuations. NEO is another one, and then there's, you know, smaller ones that have kind of different components. You have Icon, you have Dragon Chain. Zilliqa is another one that's kind of implementing sharding in, and some other kind of components to maybe help from a scalability perspective. But yeah, it'd be interesting to watch.
I guess what I'm interested in is when we start seeing some things built on top of them that actually being widely used. I'm still yet to see that.
Yeah. And that's interesting because the killer app right now for Ethereum has been number one ICOs. That's really been the killer app, is raising money on Ethereum. But outside of that, it's been CryptoKitties. And so there's not that much there. But I think also too, like from looking at how some of these companies or how some of these systems are being set up, there's so many developers that are, I think, building a knowledge base with Solidity. And some of these platforms are either developing with Solidity in mind, like using Solidity as their programming language, or allowing developers to like port over Solidity based apps, which will be, because I think even like I was saying before, if you have such an awesome platform, but at the same point in time, if nobody knows like the language that you're using or whatever it might be, or there's no easy way for them to move an application from Ethereum to Cardano or something like that, are they actually going to do that? Who knows?
Yeah. See, one of the things I read yesterday, was an attack against Ethereum in that a Turing complete language itself is a threat, because why would large companies risk smart contracts breaking, smart contracts being executed, which essentially lock up funds, like what's happening with Parity.
Yeah.
There's too much risk associated with this, especially if they're going to be operated with immutable blockchains.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it definitely makes sense. I think there's a case for immutability in some respects for some use cases, and in some use cases it doesn't make sense. Like, you know, I think even if you look at like banking or something like that, where it's like, you know, if somebody goes out and steals my ATM card information and they go take $3,000 out of an ATM, I can call it, and I've had that happen to me before, where it's like I put my, you know, put my card in an ATM that had some like chip in it, and then somebody stole a bunch of money from me, and I called my bank and said, "Hey, that wasn't me. That I obviously didn't take out a bunch of cash." And they're like, "Okay, we'll refund you."
Yeah.
And that's not immutable.
Yeah.
But that's advantageous to me. On the other end, if that was a like blockchain based solution, it'd be, "Hey, too bad, sorry."
Yeah.
You know.
And sometimes almost like celebrating the hacker.
Yeah.
In this weird kind of way that they've exposed a flaw in a contract, or they've exposed a flaw in the system, but, you know, they should be able to keep the funds because code is law.
Yeah. Yeah. And like going to the parity thing too, it's kind of like, so maybe I'm on the, maybe I'm kind of the belief that like it's kind of bad code, and, you know, Ethereum is supposed to be immutable. You can make the argument that it's not, but Ethereum is supposed to be immutable, and, you know, kind of too bad. But at the same point in time, I didn't have any money in a parity multisig wallet. Yeah. So it's easy for me to say, "Hey, it's too bad." You know, if you had a couple $1 million in a parity multisig wallet, then you might be thinking otherwise and thinking, "Hey, please save me," or something like that. So,
and nobody's harmed by returning the funds. It's the, it's not sat with anybody else.
No.
But at the same time, it sets a precedent.
Exactly.
Which in the future is, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, totally.
Which future smart contract, which locks up money in a different way, you know, Ethereum in a different way, can, you know, will we need to have another hard fork for?
Yeah.
there is rumors, and there are things I've read that have discussed in this, potentially there will be a hard fork of Ethereum, and we will have a third Ethereum chain based on this, based on those disagreeing with this.
I've seen that as well. I haven't done like the full research into it, so I know, yeah, I haven't done like the full level. I think that's been kind of prominently coming out in the past 24, 48 hours of people talking about that. But that would be not great. I'm not a big fan of like, so I get kind of the purpose behind forks and a lot of that. But and even like Bitcoin, like I get the argument for Bitcoin Cash. I get a lot of the things around it. But, you know, in a lot of respects, it is kind of hijacking the name of, it's, you're taking a lot of the brand value. And then also from like a market cap perspective, I think it's kind of funny too, because like, I was kind of thinking about this. I saw somebody writing about Bitcoin Private recently. That was the ZCL Bitcoin fork. And Bitcoin Private's, I think, market cap was either higher than Monero, higher than Zcash.
Higher than Zcash.
So yeah, their market cap was higher than Zcash. But out of the people like that actually, you know, that market cap, like how many people actually have access to that Bitcoin Private? It's only traded on, it's like had $2 million worth of 24-hour volume. Like it's super small. Like just the metrics, the economic metrics behind a fork are just so jumbled because of, you know, if you have your stuff on a ledger, is Ledger going to support that? Is it not going to support that? If it doesn't, then does that actually exist? That's not calculated into a market cap. And it's, I think it just goes to like show that the metrics there can be kind of crappy.
Yeah, it's a really tough one with the forks, because sometimes people will be like, "Oh, I've got free money." You know, that was the big thing around Bitcoin Cash, and then
it's a dividend.
It's a dividend, and then it kicked off this trend of future forks, but nothing really. The only thing, the only other one that had a little value was Bitcoin. Was it gold?
Gold, yeah. Which is still going back to that point, still multi-billion-dollar. Has anybody ever used Bitcoin Gold?
Will anyone use Bitcoin Gold? I just...
Multi-billion dollars, though.
Yeah. Well, and then I think, who's buying this when you're selling it into the market, and why, and, you know, what's... It just seems insane. It's another thing which is kind of amateurish and strange within this industry we work in.
Totally.
And trying to then explain it to somebody. You know, if you're trying to explain to somebody new, come in and say, "Well, yeah, we have this virtual currency, it's called Bitcoin, but if anyone wants to create their own version, they can just fork it and give it a similar name, have miners support it, and it'll have that." When you start trying to explain it, it just sounds insane. And also, before we started, I think I said to you, Vitalik Buterin has put out there to he's going to boycott Consensus, and he's asking others to do the same. And also, this is following him calling out Craig Wright a fraud, and he won't be attending any
conferences with him.
Or was that that might have been Charlie Lee? Why is he there? He seems to be getting quite a name for himself out there.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of this Consensus thing?
There's so many. I mean, for me personally, there's so many like things to worry about. There's so much shit going on in the space that it's like there's only so many things I can really concern myself with and get mad about.
Otherwise, you boycott everything.
Yeah. Otherwise, you just get literally. I mean, but that's like Twitter and that's the crypto world right now. It's literally just getting mad about every single thing that goes on, and I just don't care enough at this point in time too. I mean, honestly, like if there's anything to boycott, it's the fact that the tickets are $3,000. Like outside of that, like that's what I would boycott is $3,000 conference tickets, and not necessarily the, you know, the fact that
I didn't like, realize they were $3,000 now.
The final tickets. I think they were $2,500, and then they just upped them recently. I got an email. I was thinking about attending since it's in New York and we're in New York, but it's a pretty hefty. Pretty hefty price tag.
I don't think I've ever been to a conference at $3,000 a ticket.
I think it's a 3-day conference. And I mean, to their credit, the speaker lineup does look pretty solid. But I also, if I'm not mistaken, I think that they stream the entire event. I feel like I saw the last consensus and they basically streamed the entire thing live. So it's, you know, pay $3,000 or stream the exact same content live. And yeah, you can make a lot of connections there in person. And there's a lot of, you know, kind of important, powerful people, blah, blah, blah. But at the same point in time, who knows? That's a lot.
I'm not sure that calling for a boycott really achieves anything or solves anything apart from... I don't think that's the way to deal with the debate.
Yeah.
I don't think that's helpful for the industry either. I'm not sure... I'm not really sure what he's trying to achieve with that. I think within... If you read the... You know, he starts with pointing out that there's a scam. I don't think that's CoinDesk aptly the promote. That's probably someone else's mistake. But then moves on to their incorrect reporting of Ethereum. So it felt a bit more personal.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also... So, like, CoinDesk, I think, does do some... Like, they'll have... I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily BitConnect, but they do a lot of, image-based... advertisements and things like that, and you can pretty often see like different advertisements for maybe shady ICOs or things like that that are going on like on the actual like website itself. And I don't know if that's maybe what he was referring to, but I've seen criticism for that, and I think Ryan Selkis, who used to be at CoinDesk, I've seen people give him crap and say, or like even just saying like, hey, wish you were still at CoinDesk because like, you know, I don't know, so and so. So I think there is something to be said there from like a journalism perspective, I guess, as far as where they're monetizing and who they take money from. But if it's like an ad network, maybe they don't have as much control over it. Who knows?
But he made it over 3 points. So that was point one. Point two was that statements are made off the record, don't stay off the record. And the third one was incorrect reporting Ethereum. I just wonder whether if he'd have called for the boycott on the scams alone, or that was his leading point.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Out of the people that probably are attending, I don't know if anybody are thinking about attending. Who knows how many people are going to be like, oh, okay, Vitalik, you know, boycotted this, so I'm not going to go. I kind of doubt that's going to happen that much. But at the same point in time, maybe you know, maybe it just kind of makes some people think twice about visiting the CoinDesk website or something. Like, who knows? You know, it seems like that might have more of an effect rather than ticket sales at, you know, at consensus.
Are you going?
I'm probably not.
Probably
not. I'm still thinking about it, but if I can stream the entire thing, I might just try to meet up with some people before, meet up with some people afterwards, and try to network in that way rather than
I was thinking of coming into New York for it, but
part of the like blockchain week as a whole, which will be interesting.
Yeah, and you can meet up with a whole bunch of people, and you know, I think some of the networking is more important than the actual conference itself. And like you say, look, if they're streaming it for free, So anyway, so what else is going on with you at the moment?
So just kind of continuing with the content, and then right now we're in AirSwap's office, so kind of started here. Month and a half ago, and company just launched the AirSwap token trader platform yesterday. So that's been pretty cool to see, and pretty fun to just be a part of as far as seeing a platform. Like, I've always worked at large companies. I've always worked at basically pretty much worked at like 2 Fortune 500 companies, and I never had any impact on product whatsoever. So even just getting a chance to see developers and engineers actually building this stuff and like testing it out, it's pretty fascinating to watch in comparison to like what I used to have an impact on from just a product standpoint, because it was nothing.
It's a pretty cool product as well, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it kind of gets adoption in the space, but I'm biased, but I'm pretty impressed by the product.
Well, I think, like I said to you before, sometimes I use Shapeshift because I'm lazy and I can't be bothered to log in to my exchange with my authenticator code and my password and IP protection and every other thing I have in place. And also, I don't like to create market orders. Mm-hmm. I like to just buy from the order book. So for me, and also another thing I really like about what they've done is that it looks great. There seems to be a big issue with usability and UX within crypto. You know, something like My Ether Wallet for me is just fucking terrible. It's just so horrible to use. They've done a lot of work in the UX.
Yeah, I think Don, one of the co-founders who I think you had spoken to earlier, his background I think is kind of on the UX side of the house, and I do completely agree with you. I mean, that's something from like a crypto standpoint that. There's a really, I've seen a lot of people talk about this, but there's a far way to go in terms of actually generating usability for the products or the platforms that people are leveraging outside of like the hardcore kind of crypto nerds that can just figure something out, even if it looks ugly or if it's not easy to use, they'll figure it out. They'll leverage it. But for the average person, there has to be some level of kind of a nice user experience, nice interface for that to go down.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of excuses made for it, like, we're figuring out how this technology works and, UX can come later. But I always feel like UX and UI should be baked in from the start.
Yeah, totally.
Because otherwise you're just going to be re-engineering your product in the future for that. So the other thing you talked to me about is you've got an interest in the regulatory side of things.
I think that's just crazy. It's developing like crazy right now. One of the more interesting things I think happening right now, it's just a big argument about Ethereum being a security or ETH being potentially a security. And there's a lot of, I think, like Bitcoin people that are on like the Bitcoin or Bitcoin maximalists are saying, hey, it's a security. You guys are all screwed. And obviously, if ETH is a security, then all the tokens built on the ERC-20 standard are basically security as well. And that would, I think personally, that would be a negative for the industry as a whole and even for Bitcoin, because I do think that there's a lot of people that buy Bitcoin or hold Bitcoin too to access other crypto assets or to gain access to those. So I do think it would kind of be negative in a lot of respects. I don't know. That's one thing that there's just so many conflicting. There's a lot of people that go back and forth. I think Preston Byrne is, I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, he's one person that has he's a lawyer that has a ton of opinions on the subject. And then I think it's Peter Van Valkenburg from CoinDesk was providing some other kind of insights as far as he's saying, hey, it's absolutely not. Preston's like, yeah, it is. So there's a lot of back and forth. I'm not a lawyer, so I have no idea one way or another, but I try to read up on those things and somewhat keep an understanding of kind of where things are moving. But I do think the regulatory kind of framework is going to move pretty quickly in the near future.
Okay, cool. And then just to wrap things up, what's coming up for you? How can people stay in touch? How do people get hold of you?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So trying to do my daily videos as much as possible on the channel. So if you need to find that, I have a website. It's just cryptobobby.com, cryptobobby.com.
I'll share that.
Yeah, it has links to everything there. And then if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's crypto_Bobby there. Just kind of continuing for me working on kind of contributing at AirSwap, trying to make sure that the token trader goes as smoothly as possible and working with some other external projects on that as well. And then just looking forward to interacting with as many people as possible, be at some events in the near future. So just follow me on Twitter and I'll let you know when I'm going to those events.
Quick event. Listen, great to meet you. Thanks for dinner last night. It was cool.
Awesome, man. Cheers. Great to meet you as well.
Okay, cool. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Rob. He's a really great guy. I'll share all the links to his social media channels in the show notes so you can check him out on YouTube and Twitter. He's a really cool guy, has a really good knowledge of the space and really good guy to follow. As I mentioned in the intro, I do have a training course available on my website now. You can access that at www.whatbitcoindid.com. Feel free to have a look, tell me what you think, any feedback, good or bad. Outside of that, feel free to get in touch about anything, follow me on social, share the podcast with your friends, and I will have the interview with Don from AirSwap out next week. Okay, have a great week.